Session number 9424, reel 8.
Mr. Cooper, reel 8.
You were recounting a story of a raid on the post that you'd served in when
yes.
you were in the front line.
Yes, and we were in support line at the time.
What was your reaction to the news of the outcome of that German raid?
Oh, very, very depressing. I knew some of the chaps there, but we weren't closely associated. But when I thought what we had missed, and that I might have been lying dead there in prison, well, it was quite fearsome, and to think what we'd escaped, and the relief that we hadn't stayed in there. That's about the reaction. But we realised that could happen any time, really, so we were never safe. Although we did feel safe in support, because before they got to the support, they had to go through the front line. But I do remember we thought, and our corporal thought, when all this barrage of machine guns was coming, that if they got through the support line, it might have been coming right through a real big attack, and coming right through to the support line, reserve line, canal and everything. But as it happened afterwards, well, it was just a raid on the one post.
But can you remember what you felt at the time when your corporal was saying this could be a really big attack?
Well, I got the wind up, of course. Yes, we felt fear, because we imagined the next thing would be that they'd be coming right through and on against our barricades in the reserve line. Just the same as it might have been like on April the 18th. It might have been the beginning of a big attack right through the canal. So although we felt this, what we had escaped, in not being in the post that was raided, where we also realised what we'd escaped in, that it wasn't really a big attack, that we might have been prisoners or dead if it had been a proper attack right through.
Was at the time of that attack, were all the support lines standing too? Were they all
ready? Oh, well, they were all standing too all night. Well, not stand to everybody. We weren't actually, when it came, no, we had our sentries on and the others off, but of course directly that side, well, they're all woken up out of their tambours to stand to. But really the term stand to was always just before dawn, when everybody was on the alert, nobody sleeping at all. But if anything happened, of course, well, everybody was rooted out. They weren't allowed to sleep when something was going on, of course. No, it was just an escape, really.
Thank you. Could we now move on to what you did next? I believe you didn't go up to Packet Wood again.
No, we went out on rest then. So we had our 7 days, perhaps, of rest. And the next time we went up was on the, well, on the left of Packet, on the left of Rees de Vinage, yes, into support line. And the corporal we had was Jarvis Smith. And when we got to the trench, it was a continuous trench by then. Well, I think one of the guys scrambled over our section. He said, "Well, your our section, get in here, you see." And we said, "Oh, it's all wet down there." And he said, "Oh, what do you bother? You can't bother about a bit of wet." Anyway, he didn't mind. I said, "Well, if we went about 20 feet along, we'd be all right," which we did. Which was a good thing, because subsequently, when there was one of the night bombardments, well, in the part we were going, well, one shell went right in there, so we'd have all been killed. Anyway,
did that shell actually kill anyone at all?
No, it was just in a little blank part of the trench. But then there was a lot. Almost every night there was an awful lot of shelling, and then one night this shelling went on for I suppose, really. It was only half an hour, and a lot of them near misses, and heard them coming through there with their tearing roar and explosion. And then when it ceased, we heard cries from the post nearest, just on the very edge of Vis de Vernage, and someone said, "Oh, come on, we're nearly blown to pieces here." And I think, there was only one that wasn't injured, but there wasn't one killed, if I remember right, but one had both his legs almost blown off, and the other shell shocked, and the shell had landed just on the very edge of the... And the stretcher bearers came. I remember there was one chap, now what was his name? Well, it doesn't matter, really. And it was his 19th birthday. And he was carried down the line. That was I had both his legs broken. And the corporal was pretty shell-shocked and said, "Oh, get me out of here, get me out of here." And I think there were three or four stretcher loads taken away. And it was only 10 yards from where we were.
In instances like that, how long did it take the stretcher parties to arrive?
Oh, 10 minutes or so, quarter of an hour. They're very, very quick, really. They weren't Royal Army Medical Corps. They were battalion stretcher boys. That's why, of course, some of the troops used to look down on the RAFC, because they didn't come into action until the chaps had got well behind the line. Because they used to, first of all, the stretchers they'd taken down, there'd be some cars or lorries just by the canal, you see, which the stretcher bearers would take them to. Then they'd be taken down to what they call the CCS, that's Casualty Clearing Station, or aid post. And then from there, they'd either be sent down the line to hospital, and that's until they were better ready for service again.
In the times where they were wounded in the trench like that, was any medical assistance given to them by the troops?
Yes, we all had our first aid. We had iodine and bandages and the cotton wool pads. Yes.
Was anything done for these men who were injured by the shell exploding?
Well, I didn't. Our people, I don't think, did anything. But I think the first thing they did was to call for the stretcher bearers.
How was that done? Was that done by telephone or just shouting out?
No, just shouting out, stretcher bearers. And they just seemed to appear by magic. I think sometimes they were alongside the trench. But they soon seemed to get to the road for them.
Mm-hmm. Were any of these stretcher bearers people like conscientious objectors, do you know?
I never inquired, but I expect some were, possibly. Although I think most of the conscientious objectors joined the Royal Army Medical Corps, or else were drivers, ambulance drivers and so on. Because all the Quakers, you know, I had some of my relations and my parents were Quakers years ago, and my mother's friends had children. I remember one of them, he joined, he was an ambulance driver in France. He was a conscientious objector, as all Quakers are.
Okay, can we continue with... your days in the trenches in the front line there, near Vis de Vernage.
Well, it was mostly nightly bombardments. Of course, you might ask, well, why these bombardments? Well, the bombardments were that it reduced your morale to be shelled every night, and hear these shells shooting, and it's just avoiding them every night. So if at any time when, say, 3 or 4 days the Germans were going to attack, you weren't at the top of your form, really, having been shelled every night and kept awake from sleep. I think that's one of the main reasons for it was. And I remember that was mainly just shelling. And then, of course, ration parties. There always somebody picked out, say, two men from each section or one man from each section, and then we had to go down to the canal bank where all the limbers, that means horse-drawn things, came up with the rations from behind. And then you all got... I think the Germans probably knew about what time the ration parties were on, so they used to shell near the canal. And it was always a very hazardous, nerve-wracking thing to be on a ration party. And you just get back as quickly as you could to the to the line.
One thing I didn't mention at the beginning was the terrain in this new post any different from?
No, just the same. One big stretch of flat land. Quite a lot of grass and stuff still growing. It wasn't all mud and rats or anything like that. Because, as I mentioned before, the area where we were in Packet Wood and Rees de Vinage, etc., had been open country until April. During the 4 years of war, they never had an enemy on it, you see, or a shell.
Mm-hmm. And were you still in the machine gun corps?
In the Lewis section gun section. Yes, still in the Lewis gun section.
While you were in the line, did your duties change at all?
Well, there was one particular night in the trench, I think a support line between, just on the, well on the left of Packet Wood, and the corporal called me, he said, oh, you've got to go, you've got to pack your things up and go back to company headquarters. Well, of course, my first fear was, I thought, good heavens, what am I wanted for? I thought perhaps my mother had died or something like that, you see. Anyway, he said, well, the corporal runner's here, you've got to go back with him, so get your thing. There wasn't much to pack up anyway. Fighting out then, so I went with him down to towards the canal bank and along a trench, and we went to the sergeant major's dugout. Well, it wasn't a dugout because it was on the level, but my word, what a surprise. Your lovely square place where you had a candle inside, lifted up the curtain, all the floor covered with straw and big protected roof of sandbags. And he said, well, are you Cooper? I said, yes, sir. He said, oh, you're not Cooper. I said, yes, I am. He said, oh, well, come in. And he said, now, they want an intelligent man for the observer corps, battalion observers. He said, well, can you map read? I said, yes, I can, because I was on a map reading course once. He said, oh, well, I think you'll do. And he asked me various questions, and then, of course, an unheard of thing got quite pally. He said, well, what about a cup of tea? Well, I mean, to a private, a sergeant major, never, it was like God asking you to have a cup of tea. So he got a nice cup of hot tea and we drank that, and then he said, all right, well, I think you after several other questions, I think you'll do. He said, you might have a bit of sniping to do, which rather alarmed me.
And why did it alarm you that...
Well, because the snipers are such a dangerous... in such a dangerous position, I felt.
Did you really understand what an observer, what duties an observer
no,
would take?
No, not very much, no, no. Anyway, he said, well, the runner will take you down to to battalion headquarters. So I went down with him and reported. And then they took me to the observers quite near the canal into a cottage. And then I met the others, there were four of them. And then they said, oh, well, you better have a doss down. So they had a little dugout under the house, so I went and slept in there.
What led to you being picked for the observers, do you think?
Well, it was rather a streak of fortune in a way, because I remember when I was in the trenches one day, the shells were going out, somebody said, oh, there's a house on the canal bank has been struck. And of course, then I learnt later, of course, that was the little billet where the observers were. And also that two of them had been killed, and the roof blown in on the house, and terrible condition. And that's what really, I suppose, a lucky break for me. That's why I was allotted to them.
When you met them, were the survivors in good spirits?
No, they were very shaken, and the little room that there was all covered with masonry and blood all down the walls and on the floor where the others were killed and wounded and bled.
Did they talk about the incident at all?
Yes, and they were very jumpy too, you see, because they kept thinking another shell might come on the house. Anyway, the next morning, well, they started giving me the routine and said, oh, well, Charlie, we'll take you up to the observation post, which is in the, just by the front line in the Ries de Vinage. And so we went in daylight, just walked up, and then we got to Ries de Vinage, where we were pretty well sheltered from view, and then we saw this small one-story house, and we walked through a desolated garden and through a big hole in the wall, and then we went up the stairs to the attic. Then I saw the other two observers that were on duty there, and they had a very strong telescope pointing through where the roof joined the edge of the house, and they had this telescope through, and they had it sacking all around so that the enemy wouldn't, I suppose, notice anything. And then they went, and then Charlie Finlay got out the maps and told us what the area was to observe, and he showed me where we were on the map, and he said, now look through, he said, now we're a few miles from Metrum. He said, you'll have a look through the telescope. So I looked through and I saw twin towers of a church, you see. He said, well, that's about four, a few miles away. It seemed very close. And then he said, and the stairs, you can see the roofs are there. Generally, everything looks so close. Then he sort of put me on, and he said, now have a look. And as close as I am to you now, I saw a German right up, he looked about 5 feet away, and he was just looking around like that. And it took my breath away. There was I looking at the enemy, and he apparently looking into my eyes. And he was, of course, I suppose he was about 50 yards or even 100 yards away. And then we just had to scan the air and see if we could see anybody, any movements or Germans getting out of trenches or any movement at all. We couldn't see far enough back to behind the lines. Well, we could, but we didn't see any vehicles or anything. And we had to report this to every movement we saw and where different posts were, and any movement of new wire and so on to the intelligence officer. But it was a very cushy job because we were only up there, I can't remember how many hours we were there, for 2 or 3 hours, and then we packed up.
Yes, were you on a field telephone system? So
oh, no, no telephone.
So how did you report?
Well, because we had to report to the intelligence. He came while we were there. He used to pop in, you know, for during the time we were there.
Could you describe the actual routine of how you observed the front line? How did you use the maps and the telescope together? What sort of things did you have to do?
Well, by map references. Of course, the main thing we had to do was to avoid being seen, because the front line trench went round the front of our house. So there we were in the attic of right on the edge of the front line. Therefore, we had to make very sure that no movement was seen at all. And that's why we had the sacking round the hole where we had the telescope. Well, we'd see a certain thing, and we'd look at the map, and then just about gauge where it was and put down the map reference where we'd seen this movement.
Mm-hmm. How many were in the observer section that you were in?
I think there were six. I think there were only four of us. Let's see. Four of us and the corporal.
And how many worked? Do you work in twos all the time?
In twos, yes. Worked in twos.
Now, how long was the shift for? Or the duty, I should say.
Well, say a morning and an afternoon. Of course, when we got back to this little dugout, we were in the dugout, but when we were in the house, of course, you never knew any minute when they might decide to drop another shell on it, but they didn't. Mm-hmm. And also, we had two members of the Pioneer Corps with us, you know, who did the vetting in trenches and that sort of thing.